Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. I'm going to try to talk to you about what we found when we did some bias analysis. I prefer to call it bias analysis, but sensitivity analysis has already been slipped in there. Sensitivity analysis has a way of being very vague and can include all sorts of things from influence analysis to model specification issues, which I'm not going to be talking about. I'm going to be talking about bias or systematic error. So this is the outline of the talk. I would first talk about how, at least our own philosophy at UCLA and within the group, how we think about the Duke findings and how we think about one of those explanations that you could have for the findings we had so far in terms of bias and how you could go about adjusting for the biases, the framework, and the approach we use. And my colleague will come up and give us some illustration or case studies, and we'll have some concluding remarks. We try to keep it simple. We try to make it accessible. So if it's too simple, don't feel offended. If it sounds too abstract, please do stop us and ask us questions. We are pretty happy to talk about these things. Now, explaining Duke findings. Why would you want to explain it? After all, those that give us all the fancy models, fancy framework, everything is in there. All you have to do is plug in the numbers, perhaps. But when you start looking at this framework, and you have things coming from the outside to the inside, and gets deeper and deeper, you can imagine that this is a huge undertaking. If it is this huge, it cannot all go very well, can it? So if you are like me and you're a skeptic, or quantitative skeptic, you would want to subject what you're doing to some form of analysis, some form of what-if analysis. What if things went wrong? And what sorts of things could go wrong? And by how much would they sort of impact how I explain my results or how I interpret my results? Well, so considering the association findings, we love the word association. People love to talk about the vagueness of this association. But when you get down to it, I can imagine the WHO, the EU, all the people who are represented here, I suspect most of them are not even interested in association. I may be wrong, because at the end of the day, you're interested in policies. You're interested in making changes. You're interested in improving the system. And if all you have is association and not causation, you gotta have to explain this to the taxpayer or whoever is paying for it. Why are you investing in it if it doesn't mean etiology? If it doesn't mean, if I change something here, I see a difference here. So although as scientists we shy away from the language of causation, a lot of what we do has to do with causation, especially from a policy perspective. And if we can't get there, at least pretend to be working in that direction, we're wasting taxpayers' money. That's something I feel very strongly about. So many times when I do work, I'm interested in trying to find out, what have I got? I've got layers of things going on. Have possible ways that things can be explained. And one that is really important is, well, when I'm looking at causal, is it possible that high-quality management does lead to better patient empowerment or some other outcome? Just use this as an example. Or have I got systematic error or bias? That is, there is something that increases quality management, also increases patient empowerment. But patient empowerment and high-quality management, one does not lead to the other. That's a possible explanation. Or have I got both of these things going on? That is, this one perhaps leads to the better outcome in addition to some other things that lead to both of them. That could be an explanation. Or it's just a chance finding. I couldn't replicate it like you said. I couldn't go into the countries, did an improvement project, did a trial, and find anything. It was just one-time fluke, sample error. So, in a perfect world for policy interventions, in fact, in an imperfect world, especially in an imperfect world for policy interventions, what we want to do is increase our chances of making causal claims and reduce our chances of systematic error or bias. It would be a disaster to spend all this money doing projects, collecting data, wasting man hours, only to find out that the things you're putting forward do not mean that if you invested in the thing you claim was an important intervention variable or intervention area, would not lead to any change in the system. It would be a waste. I will feel that I wasted my time. So we want to reduce the chances of these other types of explanations that we don't want and increase our chances of this. What is interesting about this, and it took people from outside the health sciences to get us to start thinking about this, like, you know, artificial intelligence, say robotics, where they are interested in causation. They're really interested in that. They said, well, it turns out for you to increase the chances of this, you have to be willing to make untestable assumptions, mostly untestable assumptions. This is where your theory comes in. You got to decide whether a symptom causes disease or disease causes symptom. Your software, your statistics will not tell you that. It's just data, garbage in, garbage out. So our theory is quite important. So to do that, we need to think about the structure or the theory underlying whatever we're doing and then impose those assumptions in our analysis. Hence, there is need for us to do analysis checking how sensitive our findings are to some of the biases that arise from those assumptions or the things that could be going on. So I'll talk about the sources of bias. In the health sciences, we find it quite useful to think about systematic error in terms of these three things. Some people will give a list much longer than this, but I haven't found use for anything longer than this. Every type of systematic error I found easy to classify under one of these three. But of course, if you have other ideas, I would love to hear them. These are uncontrolled confounding due to unmeasured variables. That means there are other variables that explain the relationship that you're interested in, but you didn't measure them, therefore you didn't control for them. There's selection bias. You can imagine a case where you have selective non-response. Some people were invited to the study, they didn't participate. They refused. You talked about how some people said, oh no, I'm not gonna be in this study, sorry. Then you have measurement error. And that is, this can happen when someone or your instruments are not tapping into the things we want them to tap into. For categorical variables, we talk about misclassification. But you can imagine cases where someone has the wrong BP, blood pressure because they got the wrong instrument or because maybe they were smoking something before they took the measurement. Or the people helping you in the field were not collecting what they should collect. We've had cases, not in this study, I've heard of cases where people who were doing the field studies went out and decided to smoke a joint and filled out the questionnaires and returned them and never even spoke to the respondents. So you could have a bunch of these things and you think you got real data. And I know institutions where they think their data are sacrosanct, but they're not. These sources of biases are often neglected in large studies or meta-analysis where they matter most. Small studies, I personally believe, are usually too small to say anything on their own, much less trying to tease out these things. You have so much sampling variation problem that systematic error doesn't even come into the picture. So these types of biases can occur singly or jointly, that is, in various combinations. You can have uncontrolled confounding only, or you could have it with same selection bias, or even measurement error. And they can occur once or multiple times in sequence, especially in longitudinal data. Now, bias analysis can address all of these things. The problem is that bias analysis is quite tedious. It's very time consuming. It was only more recently that we had the computing power to be able to do this. Some of these analyses can run for days, a week, or more, and you're just working on one case scenario. However, what is interesting is that with the computing power we now have, we can do some more sophisticated analysis and give all the sources of bias one framework where we consider the biases as missing data. And I'll quickly go through those. What I mean, so for instance, consider uncontrolled confounding. What I have here is nothing more than how we think about things. These are, this type of diagram is often referred to technically as a directed acyclic graph. Acyclic meaning that you can begin on one variable, say x, and move along the arrows and come back to x. So no variable is the parent of itself, and the arrows represent direction of influence or even causality. So confounding will simply be, in this simplest scenario, very simple, we're trying to keep it simple here, will be where this is what I'm expecting. Say for instance, high quality management, and this is an outcome, say a patient outcome, and U or Z would represent other variables that cause both of them or associated with both of them, but do not indicate, are different from, say, the effect of high quality on patient outcome. What we want is to isolate this. We do not want these. We do not want these. How do we remove them? We control for them in observational studies. But you can only control for something you measured. So if I measured this, I can control for it. But if I didn't measure this, I cannot control for it. Which means when I examine the relationship between this and this, I'm going to have this relationship here plus this relationship which I did not control for. That is uncontrolled confounding. That, if you looked at it from a missing data perspective, says that I have no measurements on U, this variable U, whatever it is. Say the likelihood for a hospital to, you know, invest in manage in quality measurements. What you have is missing data on you for all the study participants. You can do the same thing for selection bias, a classic way we represent selection bias, meaning that those you observe, selection X, what one means the people who responded to your study, this could be referring to the individuals, but could also be referring to the hospitals. Those you have them there for a reason or through a mechanism that is related to their exposure, say, the quality management system they have, and the outcome they have, and perhaps some other things you know about them, such that those you did not observe, called the S equals zero people, you do not have any measurement on them. It makes sense. You didn't observe them, they didn't participate, so you have no measurements on them. Now, you would ask, why is this a problem? It is a problem because the fact that you observe these people is equivalent to conditioning of this variable. This was something that took, you know, talking to robotics folks when they were programming their robots to find out that what we have here is a classic collider case. That is, if I looked among these participants, if quality systems are not related to outcomes, I'm going to find a relationship between them within this group. Think about it this way. Say that those who have high quality systems are those who are more likely to participate, and those who have better patient outcomes are more likely to participate. But in reality, assume that there is no relationship between X and Y. If I look in this group of people and I find high levels of high quality systems, what am I going to find of Y? I'm going to find less of Y because they both cause it. The reason they ended up here, if this causes this and this causes that, and if I find someone here who has a high level of this, that person by definition will have a lower level of this. And it will look like there's an inverse relationship between these two, when in fact there was none. We need to take care of selection bias. This happens more in a classic cohort studies, follow-up studies you have in epidemiology. Measurement error, I'll soon be done. We can also give a missing data thing like we did for uncontrolled confounding and like we did for selection bias. In uncontrolled confounding, we didn't have a measurement on a certain variable on everybody. In selection bias, we didn't have any measurement on all the people who didn't participate, who should have participated. But the mechanism in which participation was observed had something to do with the actual measurements we have in front of us. This one, again, is a different case. What happens is that we want to have a measurement of, say, quality systems and all the other things, but we didn't get the real X. We got the X star, some measure of quality management. That is not quite what we're looking for. That is a bit removed from it. Now, if we looked at it, and hopefully it's related, that these are positively related, if we look at our measurement of quality management system and the outcome, we're going to find a relationship that, for all intents and purposes, might be attenuated or smaller than what we were interested in because of this additional path here. So this is what we want, but this is what we get from here to here. This is some noise we don't need. So we can see this as missing data because we are missing the true X on everybody. So how do we take care of this? Well, we just said we'll think of it as missing data, so that's one way we can take care of it within a missing data framework. But there are two approaches that we generally subscribe to, that we work on, that we use in analyzing these things. One is external adjustment, one is missing data. The external adjustment simply is something you do after you finish the analysis, you have a result in front of you, say regression coefficient and odds ratio, then you do something to that odds ratio to correct for what you think went wrong. You can do this in the back of an envelope, you can do this in Excel, it's simple, but you have to use formulas. Some of these formulas have been getting more complicated. My students tell me that they get so complicated they don't know how to program them anymore, but you can use simpler formulas which make stronger assumptions, or you can use the more complex formulas that are, you know, are far more flexible, don't impose extra assumptions. The only thing is that you need to have more information to be able to use them. The other thing you could do is take a missing data approach. A missing data approach will use methods that integrate with your main data analysis. So you don't finish the data analysis before you do the correction. You start before the main data analysis, you go back and you fill in the data that are missing using your bias models. Then carry out the analysis with the fuller data that you might have had. So what do I mean? So one way to summarize it is to say you create a model that gives, that reflects the mechanism for the missing data, say missing the uncontrolled confounding variable or the selection bias mechanism or the measurement error model. You combine it with your observed data, and you have a fuller data that you might have observed had there been no unmeasured confounders or selection bias or anything. So you can imagine a data set that is there, and you have a new U column in it that you can now use that new U under the models where you're filling in the holes to do your analysis. This is particularly attractive because what if you change your mind and you're going to run another model? You don't have to redo the calculation as you would do in external adjustment. You just run that same, another model with your U. So this is particularly attractive. And in this study, we did use this mostly, and now I'll invite my colleague to come and talk to us about the case studies, some of the findings, and at the end, we'll take questions.